Good morning, folks. You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. My name is Andrew Geller. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media, and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information is available at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. So, welcome. It's nice to have a week off last week, and looking forward to Pledge Drive beginning. Well, it actually begins tomorrow in full. I will have a show next week for an hour, but more about that at the end. Today, I'm going to be talking about several recent developments, continuing developments, regarding U.S. foreign policy, military, economic, because it's all connected. And joining me from his office in Washington to talk about this, I am pleased to bring you Colonel Dan Smith. He's a senior fellow on military affairs at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. Welcome to our airwaves, Dan.
Andrew, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, before we begin talking, I just want to explain a little bit about the Friends Committee for folks who don't know what it is and read a little bit of your biographical information, because it's a unique perspective here on our airwaves. So the Friends Committee on National Legislation is a public interest group founded in 1943 by the Religious Society of Friends to bring concerns, experiences, and testimonies of Quakers to bear on policy decisions in the nation's capital. They work on a wide range of issues, all of which you can see at fcnl.org, whether it's regional or issues like energy and the environment, civil liberties and human rights, the budget, war and peace, etc. And Colonel Dan Smith graduated from West Point in 1966, served in Vietnam for a bit, came back, had some more schooling, served at the Army Material Research and Development Command, where he wrote speeches for the commanding general. He served in the Defense Intelligence Agency and at headquarters of the Department of the Army. Six of those years with the DIA he spent in London working with the British Ministry of Defense, and then as a military attaché at the U.S. Embassy. He retired from the Army in 1992 after 26 years of service, spent about a decade after that with the Center for Defense Information, becoming Chief of Research in 1999, and has been with the Friends Committee on National Legislation for about 2.5 years now. So just wanted to let folks know a little bit about where your history places you. Okay. Now, you recently wrote in Foreign Policy in Focus, Dan, an article called Global Security Challenges, Seeing the United States as Others Do. And this article was perfect for me to come across earlier this week because it touches on a whole bunch of things I've been reading about in the past few weeks, not the least of which being the trips abroad by both George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice recently. I suppose just to start out, what's your perception of the dominant message that both Bush and Rice were trying to put out to all the countries or many of the countries that they visited?
Well, I think in both cases, the underlying message is that they are looking for more cooperation. People would say, or they would say perhaps with, I would say from, other countries. And the distinction is the with means there's a real give and take and consideration of the interests that other countries have. And the from is more akin to the we're happy to work with you as long as you agree with us, which was the dominant message of the first Bush administration. The first of the second Bush.
Right. And some would say that that's even continued into the first couple months of George W. Bush's second term in office with the there's a couple of recent nominations that have drawn a lot of criticism, both domestically and I'd say even more so internationally. Those being John Bolton being promoted to U.S. ambassador at the United Nations, a conversation about that we featured a couple weeks ago on the show. And then since then, Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Undersecretary of State or Defense, being nominated to head the World Bank.
Yes, those two have caused quite a stir. Initially, it looked like the Europeans might object to the Wolfowitz appointment, but there's an informal agreement really between the Europeans and the U.S., and that gives the U.S. the presidency of the World Bank, and the Europeans get to nominate the head of the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. Of course, this kind of leaves everybody else out in the cold, but be that as it may, it now appears that the Europeans are not going to make a huge issue out of the Wolfowitz appointment. Bolton is another matter. There is some concern, even among a few Republicans in the Senate, about him. The key test is going to be what happens to the nomination in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, mm-hmm. which has to pass on the nomination. If they approve it and it goes to the floor of the Senate, he'll be confirmed. If they don't approve it, it may well fall by the wayside.
So you think if he gets out of committee, he's got it made on the floor of the Senate?
Oh, I think so, yes.
Okay. A little hint there for folks trying to prevent that nomination. Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
And I think they were going to take up the nomination on the 6th or 7th of April, when they come back after Easter recess.
Okay, now, those actually weren't, those are sort of tangential and related to the focus of your article. I want to kind of get back to that. You begin the, you kind of have an introductory paragraph where you talk about February 17th testimony from directors of the CIA, the DIA, the FBI, and some other folks before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence regarding security and intelligence challenges facing the nation.
Yes.
And you
their
say
annual appearance before the committee.
And as you describe it, what the committee members are being told is, I mean, it's open session, so nothing classified for sure.
Right.
But still, it's sort of like safe information. Like, it's not, they're not being told things they don't want to hear necessarily. It kind of all fits within, maybe not narrow, but not as broad parameters as you feel the members should be hearing. And the first section you address is the issue of U.S. global intentions and capabilities, noting in the lead sentence that as in 2004, the chief source of worldwide instability and armed conflict in 2005 will continue to be the United States. This times well with the release of the National Defense Strategy document, I believe it was about a week ago. And do you feel that is a widely held view internationally, or is this not as widely held as you know, that statement implies?
Well, I need to be clear that the bulk of this particular article that I wrote is premised on looking, or the world, if you will, looking at the United States and that what, in fact, the CIA and DIA and the others presented to Congress was strictly a look at the world from the United States. So my premise in the article is it's fine to tell Congress how we look at the world, but the world or the Congress should also be told how the world looks at the U.S. And so that's the genesis of the statement that the chief source of instability and conflict will be the U.S. I think in many parts of the world, definitely in some countries, particular countries, we are viewed as a proverbial bull in the china shop. We send our troops everywhere in the world. We divide the world into four geographic regions outside of the United States and Canada and put a military viceroy in charge, Central Command takes care of the Middle East, and of course they're the ones involved in Afghanistan and Iraq. They would be the ones involved with Syria or Iran if anything were to break out there. We have Southern Command, which takes care of Latin America and the Caribbean, European Command, and Pacific Command. No other country dreams of, nor do they have the capability to project military power into any of these regions and into particular countries.
Yeah, the United States has some 750 or so bases around the world in, I believe it's at least 140 countries, a figure matched by no country, state, etc., any point in the history of the world.
Very true, but of course, never before have there been 191 countries.
Right.
Which is the makeup of the United Nations. The other main difference, of course, too, is that modern communications and the speed of transport allows us to move very quickly from any of those bases or forward operating locations to another point on the globe. It used to be said that the sun never set in the British Empire. Well, that's because the transportation took so long that you always had a boat or a ship running around the seas with British citizens on it. And as now today, a ship is registered to a country, and it's a sovereign territory.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My guest today is Colonel Dan Smith. He is Military Affairs Senior Fellow at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. And you can find out more about what they do on the internet at www.fcnl.org. www.fcnl.org. Now, you mentioned the idea that what the Senate and other leaders need to hear is perspective of the U.S. from other countries. To play devil's advocate, I could argue that the Bush administration, in fact, does have a perception of the United States from other countries, although in an extremely simplistic sense of either with us or against us. The Secretary of State just concluded a pan-Asian trip a couple of days ago. She spent a week in India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Japan, South Korea, and China, an area I believe widely viewed as in the Pentagon as a key area that we need to militarily inhabit as a country in much greater concentration than we have in quite some time. But that's not exactly a popular idea, especially with India, China, to an extent, parts of Japan, and arguments could be made regarding Pakistan, Afghanistan, and South Korea. But she went over there to work on a wide array of thorny issues that the U.S. seems to, I don't know if it's intentional or not, but they, whatever they do, it seems to kind of make things worse. How would you assess her Asian trip in terms of being able to smooth over relations and thorny issues, possibly looking at the issue of Pakistan, North Korea, and China?
That is probably the nexus of her trip. We have had improving relations with India in the last few years. But on this trip, or just prior to this trip, there was a suggestion that the U.S. would go ahead and, as a reward to Pakistan for their help in trying to track and capture or kill Taliban remnants that operate either in Pakistan or along the border with Afghanistan. They were going to get the F-16s that had been denied them back in the 1980s because of the human rights violations and the seemingly endless coups in that country, which nominally is a democracy, but hasn't functioned as one for a long time. Part of the build-up before the trip was that if Pakistan were offered F-16s, that the U.S. might make the same offer to India. So there was this attempt, I think, to try and placate India because we had to do something good for Pakistan to show the people of that country that cooperation with the U.S. is beneficial. China is in a rather unique position vis-a-vis the United States. They have huge financial reserves derived largely from their excess exports to the U.S. compared to what they import from us. They, in effect, have financed the debt that we accumulated in trade this past year. We also are putting pressure on them to bring the North Koreans back to the negotiating table, the so-called six-party talks, that are endeavoring to convince the North Koreans to end their nuclear weapons programs, both the plutonium extraction and the uranium enrichment programs that we say they have. China says it doesn't have that much influence, although it has more than anybody else.
Isn't China the reason that North Korea is more or less still able to function as a state? I mean, they receive a lot of energy and food from China, don't they?
They receive energy, food, and other support from China. On the other hand, they also receive food, financial input from South Korea. The South, back in the 1990s, initiated the so-called Sunshine Policy, which was an attempt to lower the tensions between the North and the South and to slowly but persistently push for liberalization in the North, both economically and politically, but the latter being, of course, very long range. So there are those in the Bush administration who are very unhappy both with China and South Korea because they think that this aid and support and trade is what's keeping the North Korean regime afloat. China, for its part, and South Korea, neither of them are looking for regime change of any kind. Neither of them wants economic collapse, which would be something that many in the Bush administration would not be adverse to trying to bring about. Economic collapse as well as regime change would simply open both the South Korea and China to massive influx of refugees trying to get out of the North.
Yeah, it seems like a stalemate would be preferable to that. We just have a few minutes left here, Dan, and I could talk quite a while about Asia, but I do want to touch briefly on the National Defense Strategy of the United States, which is a kind of periodic document that comes out. I don't know if it usually precedes the quadrennial review that's about to begin, but anyway.
Actually, it's supposed to follow on to the President's National Security Strategy.
Okay, and that was released last year, so...
In 2002.
Oh, 2000...
Yeah.
Okay,
This was bottled up in the Pentagon along with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's paper called the National Military Strategy.
Okay, that's the one I was referring to.
Yeah, that one was completed last year and was just held.
Okay. So have you had a chance to look through the National Defense Strategy?
Yeah, I've gotten through just about the whole thing. It's not particularly long.
No. I'm curious how you feel the message of the National Defense Strategy compares with the message of both George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice on their recent trips. Do you see them as similar? Do you see that there's differences between the messages put out?
Well, Secretary Rumsfeld's paper, National Defense Strategy, is really oriented, as one would expect, towards the military side of various instruments of national power. To that extent, the message of the paper is less heavy on diplomacy, and what Joseph Nye up at the Kennedy School at Harvard calls soft power. What is also different is that Mr. Rumsfeld talks about transformation of the military services and the military structure, which is an internal Pentagon U.S. problem and is not the kind of thing that Secretary Rice or President Bush would necessarily dwell on in their contacts with foreign nations. So that's another big difference.
And just lastly, to sort of tie together military issues related to the U.S. And China, which we just finished discussing a little bit, very current in the news is the back and forth between whether or not the European Union is going to lift its arms embargo to China. I was really amazed. You know, first it was going to go through. It's like last week, if you stopped listening to the news Friday evening, you would think, oh, yeah, that's probably going to happen. And even Monday, that was still the perception I had anyway. And then sometime between Monday and Tuesday, things reversed completely. And the EU said, nope, not going to happen.
Not for at least 6 months.
Not for at least 6 months. And the reason for that, I've read, is that Tony Blair, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, basically said he didn't want that to happen while he was president of the EU, and that begins in June.
Right.
France, however, is still pushing for a lifting of the embargo, and the U.S. is concerned because, you know, it doesn't want to potentially have to fight a war against China with all those real good weapons. So we'll just have to continue to watch that and see what happens over the course of the rest of the year.
Considering that the EU requires consensus for moving ahead, it's highly unlikely that the measure will be approved before 2006, because any one of the countries could block it. And there's been enough pressure. And as you point out, Blair doesn't want to stand up in front of George Bush and say, you can't have this. He's just not going to do it.
And we're just going to have to stop there. Thank you very much for being on the program this morning.
Andrew, I enjoyed it, and hope it helped clarify a few things for your listeners.
Well, me as well. Thank you very much. Colonel Dan Smith is a senior fellow on military affairs at the Friends Committee on National Legislation. You can find out more about them online at www.fcnl.org. If you have any questions, comments, feedback of any sort regarding this or any other show you've heard, you can email me at kboo@riseup.net.